In every film, there are minor characters that change the course of the story. Our mission is to explore those characters and give them stories of their own. This is BCD Presents No Small Parts.
It was a chilly May morning in 1880 when Odom brought his 15-year-old son, Chet, salmon fishing on the Columbia River. The two stood on the dock, watching the morning fog linger just above the water. They listened as the other crews prepared for departure, seasoned groups of men who had made this trip maybe 100 times. Chet silently shivered next to his father, careful not to seem too weak. He looked over as he heard a large man approaching them from the mist. The figure had a wide-brimmed hat and a heavy step. As he got closer, Chet could see that he wore an eye patch. Instinctively, Chet backed into his father, who let out a startled laugh. "Joe," Odom called, patting Chet's shoulder. "It's about time you got here. My son almost caught his death." The large man pulled up the brim of his hat to reveal one friendly brown eye, which he kept fixed on Chet's surprised face. "It's okay, son," Odom continued. "This is my friend Joe. He's taking us out." Joe's face broke into a wide grin. "I think I spooked your son there," he said, reaching to shake Odom's hand. "The eye patch scares the kids. They think I'm some sort of pirate." Joe led them back to his boat, a small vessel named for his late grandfather William. As the small crew headed into the water, Chet was taken by the feeling of the wind on his face. He tried to listen as Odom and Joe explained the fishing process, but Chet's mind kept drifting somewhere else, before the men pulled his attention back to the task at hand. "I think we have a dreamer here," Joe said, smiling. "It's a slow day for the fish. Maybe we can take a break. I know a story you might like." Odom gave Joe a stern look. "I don't think Chet needs to hear any of your tall tales, Joe." "Oh, come on, Odie. It will be fine," Joe begged. "The kids love this one, I promise." Chet looked at his father with pleading eyes, until Odom finally gave a nod of approval. Joe lowered his booming voice to a raspy whisper and started his story. "Our tale begins here, on the water. And it's where it will end as well." The story was unlike anything Chet had ever heard. It had everything: pirates, adventure, certain death. And the thing that really caught Chet's attention, a lost treasure. Chet could feel his heart racing, the way someone's heart does when their life is changed forever. When Joe finished his grand performance, Chet gazed at him in wonder and asked, "Is that really true, Joe?" "Oh, psh," Joe scoffed. "Of course it's true. And the best part is that the treasure is right here, somewhere in our town." Chet instinctively looked over his shoulder at the rocky coast as his father finally chimed in. "None of that is true, Chet. Every town along the coast has a story like that. It's a legend, nothing more." "But I can prove it," Joe said as he reached into his jacket pocket. "No," Odom said, looking as stern as ever. "No more stories. Let's get Chet home." Odom understood the dangers of lying to children, and he didn't want his son to believe in stories that would waste his time and break his heart. But for Chet, the seed had been planted. He rowed quietly back to the dock with the knowledge that he had just discovered his life's mission. He was going to find that treasure. Years went by, and Chet knew to never ask his father more about the story. He would often visit Joe at the docks, who refrained from giving him more information at Odom's request. Other fishermen would sometimes point Chet in the direction of locals who would know more about the actual history of the town and the truth behind the story. Although time and chores and work all seemed to get in the way, Chet never forgot about the treasure. As soon as he could man a boat without his father, he headed out along the coast in search of clues. He spent 20 years following leads, only to find dead ends. His hunt for the lost pirate gold led him to inadvertently become the town's unofficial historian. Chet chronicled all of his findings, gathering artifacts and collecting local histories. Eventually, the lure of the treasure faded, as Chet started a steady job at the local historical society, and he donated most of his findings there. But somehow, Chet could never shake the nagging feeling that he was giving up too soon. One early morning in 1921, he heard a sharp knock at the door. It was a woman with kind brown eyes. She introduced herself as Jane Sanders, the granddaughter of Joe Sanders, the one-eyed fisherman. She explained that Joe had passed away several years ago, but recently she found something in his belongings that seemed to be for Chet. She handed him a small item wrapped in brown paper. Attached was a note that said, "For Odom's son, the treasure hunter." As he held the package, Chet was overwhelmed with the memory of his first fishing trip and the story that Joe had told him. He unwrapped the item and looked at Jane in shock. She smiled and said, "When he told us the story of the treasure, this was always his proof that it was real." I know it's probably just a piece of junk, but he must have wanted you to have it. Chet could feel himself shaking, and fought tears that were now building up in the corner of his eyes. Jane politely excused herself, shutting the front door and leaving Chet alone. After he had a chance to compose himself, Chet sprung into action. He grabbed his coat and headed to the Historical Society, where he had donated an old map, one of the only tangible clues to the treasure's existence. He rushed into the curator's office, asking if he could have the map. The curator refused. "Please," Chet begged as he stood pleading before his boss. "Chet," the curator answered, "explain yourself. What's going on?" Chet reached into his pocket and dropped Joe's gift onto the curator's desk. "I have it," Chet exclaimed. "I have the key. Soon I'll be able to find the treasure." The curator didn't take his eyes off of Chet's face. For several minutes, the men stood in silence. "Chet," the curator said calmly, "I thought you were past this. The only treasure in this town is its history. Don't tell me you're scavenging again." Chet shook his head in exasperation. "You don't get it." His voice was starting to grow loud. "The map talks of a key, and this is it. Look at it. I need the map, please." The curator looked down at the piece of aged metal lying on his desk. He looked back at Chet and said, "This is just an antique. It's not going to lead anywhere. But I'll allow you to take a photo of the map if that's what you want." That day was the last one Chet ever spent in the Historical Society. Once he got the photo developed, he became as much a legend as the treasure itself. Every day he set out on the boat that his father left him, exploring routes and possibilities, holding tight to the key that Joe had left behind. He became known as a recluse, only coming to shore for necessary supplies. For the last 14 years of his life, Chet did nothing but look for treasure. In the fall of 1935, he headed back into town to visit a local shop for candles and other necessities. As he glanced around the small store, some of the candy caught his attention. "Toss one of those caramels in, please," Chet said to the clerk. As he stepped out of the store, he opened the candy package and tossed the caramel into his mouth. He looked down to see that it came with a Lou Gehrig baseball card. Chet smiled and thought to himself, "This might be a piece of history someday," and slipped the card into his journal. By age 70, Chet had been searching for the treasure for over 50 years. But he was absolutely certain that he would finally achieve his life's mission. Following the map and the key, Chet found his way through man-made tunnels along the coast of his little town. He reached the edge of a cave and listened to the echoes of running water. As he carefully crouched along the walkway, he set off some sort of trap. Chet desperately tried to move out of the way, but his age worked against him. He was struck by a boulder and pinned against the floor. He dropped his candle and watched as the light burned down. Lying there in darkness, Chet couldn't help but laugh to himself. "A booby trap," he thought. "Why set up a booby trap unless you have something to guard?" Chet died on the moist cave floor, a smile lingering on his face. No, he never saw the treasure, but he may as well have. Chet was reported missing on November 30th, 1935. No one in Astoria, the town that Chet lived in his entire life, had any idea what happened to him. Weeks went by. The publications printed stories on the local scavenger who went missing while chasing an impossible dream. Those weeks turned into months, years, decades. For 50 years, Chet's body lay just yards away from the treasure that he had searched for his entire life. For 50 years, his body lay undisturbed. Until one gloomy Saturday in the mid-1980s, a group of kids discovered Chet's body. They were following in his footsteps, carrying the map, and making their way to the legendary hidden treasure. Two of these kids were the sons of the assistant curator at the same museum where Chet donated his research. And even though most of the group didn't believe in the treasure, it was Chet's story that inspired them to search for it. When the kids found the body, they checked his bag to find a vintage Lou Gehrig baseball card and an ID that read Chester Copperpot. They took Chet's supplies and the gift that Joe had left him. It was a heavy copper key, an instrument that was vital in finding the treasure. Without Chet's emergency supplies, the kids would never have survived the treacherous trip through the caves. Without the copper key, they would never have found One-Eyed Willie's treasure. Without Chester Copperpot, Mikey, Brand, and all of their friends would never have been able to save their home. So as you can see, in the film The Goonies, there are no small parts. Thank you.